Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We have at the moment a new indication that a mortal enemy is now poised to engage in a level of warfare against us that even against the backdrop of what it has been doing to date, makes for a very ominous forecast. The Communist Party of China is that enemy, the man who is poised to become, we believe, its leader for life, its dictator, its uber thug, is Xi Jinping. And we're going to be talking in this first two blocks about a very important speech he gave on Sunday and the implications of it for all of us with one of our preeminent authorities on these matters. His name is Dr. Bradley Thayer. He is a renowned author of several important books, including most recently, I'm very proud to say, Understanding the China Threat, which is just out. And he and his co-author, Lian Chao Han, have done a superb job of preparing us for the present moment by assessing what is going on in China, again, and what it means for us. Brad Thayer is these days the director of the China Policy Program at the Center for Security Policy. He's a member of our Committee on the Present Danger of China, as I've indicated. One of our go-to people when it comes to getting this very important challenge right. Brad Thayer, welcome once again to Securing America. Great to have you with us.
Frank, it's my pleasure. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
It's always our pleasure. Let me just say, we've had a busy weekend at the Committee on the Present Danger of China, the Center for Security Policy, which sponsors it, with a couple of important developments, and I'd like to put them into play as we talk about what happened at the 20th Party Congress in Beijing over the weekend, Brad. One was we did a program on Saturday evening, Dallas time, in which we sort of went head-to-head with Xi Jinping and his friends in counter-programming, basically truth-telling about what the Chinese Communist Party is up to. It was aired by Real America's Voice, I'm very pleased to say, and I highly commend it to our audience. Had about nine extraordinarily impressive individuals commenting on the unrestricted warfare that we've been subjected to and the prospects now that it may become vastly worse. We also had a program on Sunday on Real America's Voice, a special edition of this show, Securing America, in which we highlighted a number of the webinars that we've been producing under the banner of the Committee on the Present Danger of China. A number of them you have participated very, very handsomely in, Brad. And then finally, we also issued what we call the CCP Challenge, a vehicle for having Americans, especially in these next 3 weeks, in which candidates for elective office are very interested in our views of things. The idea being that this document will help them make the case that the Chinese Communist Party is our mortal enemy, and we need a strategic course correction in dealing with it, especially in light of what Xi Jinping talked about in his opening remarks at the Party Congress. So with all of that as background, Brad, let's talk a little bit about what she said in the course of that report to the 20th Party Congress, and again, what it means for us.
Well, thank you, Frank. I think that as the panelists did an exceptional job on Saturday night and on Sunday as well, illuminating many of the dangers that Xi identified in terms of his intent to target the United States with the effort to destroy the United States and its position in international politics. My reflections on Xi's address to the 20th Party Congress are three. First, it's momentous, not simply because it happens once every 5 years, but this is a turning point in Chinese history where Xi identified that his first centenary goal has been achieved, and that was to achieve a moderately prosperous society. And now China is moving to achieve the second centenary goal, which is a modern socialist country. So from Xi's point of view, and if we reflect on that, it's his point of view, he has reached a tipping point where he's achieved one goal and is now moving towards achieving the second goal. So he's very satisfied where he is presently. So that's quite notable. Secondly, as many panelists pointed out, this very significant point, there was a degree of belligerence in that address that we have not seen that is expressed so concisely. He certainly has made those points with respect to aggression against Taiwan, aggression against the U.S., U.S. allies, India, many other states in international politics. But we had in that address just a little bit over 2 hours. It was a shorter address than was anticipated. But we had in that just over 2 hours a very concise laying out of belligerence against the Western liberal international order, U.S., U.S. allies. It calls to mind Stalin's February 1946 speech where he started the Cold War. With his address saying that capitalism and communism cannot coexist together and that communism would inevitably triumph. So the belligerence of the speech was absolutely telling and quite remarkable. Third takeaway from the speech, I think reflecting on it, is that there's an urgency that comes out of it. Both Xi Jinping conveyed an urgency, and that requires an urgent response from the U.S. and its allies.
This is the point on which we must break for a moment. We will return to it and what the implications are of that urgency and the belligerence behind it that will redound, I'm afraid, to our detriment. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. In races across the country, MAGA Republicans Joe Biden considers enemies of the state are surging past Democrats complicit in the president's wrecking operations on our economy, borders, energy security, and the military, to name but a few. Majorities in the House and Senate are now in sufficient jeopardy that Democratic politicians and their media allies have begun discussing a topic they have actively dismissed and suppressed as the big lie of election deniers, namely that fraud can determine electoral outcomes. It seems those who insisted the 2020 presidential election wasn't stolen are now worried races this year may be too lopsided to steal. So, the prospect looms that Team Biden will go for Plan B. If not Putin's nukes or a new pandemic, might the war Xi Jinping has declared on Taiwan be the pretext for postponing our 2022 elections? This is Frank Gaffney. Thank you. Welcome back. Brad Thayer is visiting with us about the momentous speech that was given by Xi Jinping, the dictator, we think now for life, at least imminently, of China. And the Communist Party Congress was the place where he delivered these very troubling remarks. And Brad, I had to interrupt you with the break, but pick up on this thought that there is now not only a very overt and concisely articulated belligerent program that is being advanced by Xi, but that there is considerable urgency associated with it. And let's talk also about why you think that might be.
Well, certainly, Frank, the urgency was present in his address in terms of the demand to resolve Taiwan, that is, in his mind, unification between the mainland of China and the Republic of China on Taiwan.
Or reunification, as he claims.
Reunification, indeed. But as you know, in history, of course, it has very modestly, actually, the historical ties are tenuous, to say the least. But the urgency that conveyed of addressing that issue, the Taiwan question, as he calls it, must be addressed, as he identified, in this decade, but we should expect much sooner. If he's saying within this decade, we should anticipate that it's immediate. And it will be the next few months, years, that we're going to be confronting this issue. And that compels, of course, with greater urgency, the need for the U.S. and its allies to respond to this danger. We have really, again, with Xi Jinping's address, we have the equivalent of Stalin's February 46 address, where Stalin, of course, identified the Cold War, that peace was not possible and there was going to be confrontation. And then that is mirrored, of course, with Xi Jinping's address, where he has done, in essence, the same thing. He's stating that he's very pleased with where the Communist Party is and his position in the Communist Party and its control over China. He does not see any change in that. And now is the time to bring about the changes that he seeks in international politics against Taiwan, India, South China Sea, the U.S. homeland, the American people, and U.S. national security interests of every scale. Are his targets.
Brad, let me just ask you to drill down on that. How explicit in the speech was he about the United States as China's main enemy and whether that could involve bringing not just the unrestricted warfare that we've seen, the economic, the political, the subversion, the elite capture and so on style, but the kinetic kind to American soil?
Indeed, Frank. There were two major points in the speech where he is, as clearly as you could expect in a speech like this, where he's identifying the United States as a threat, where he identifies that China will defeat the hegemony, right, in international politics. That is a code for the United States. And then secondly, where he said the Taiwan question would be resolved by the Chinese people without outside interference, right? In essence, I'm paraphrasing there. But those are the two identifications where he's saying that the United States is first the major threat that China faces and will not tolerate the interference of other states, meaning the United States and its allies, in any issue that affects China's territorial integrity, by which he means Taiwan and the South China Sea, Xinjiang, of course, and other disputed territories that China possesses with India, for example. So it's alarming, Frank, where he's calling the United States out as directly as we should anticipate. And of course, that compels a U.S. response.
Well, it does. And I want to talk a little bit about our challenge as part of that response. But before we do that, let me just ask, Brad, this is against the backdrop of a lot of things seemingly going quite wrong in China. And so when he is declaring that he is satisfied with where China is, he's obviously trying to obscure some of the things that have been going on of late, notably, you know, banking problems, the real estate bubble, the demographic problems, the cumulative impact of his zero COVID policy, for example, on the economy, among other things. And Brad, what does that suggest, that he is perhaps prepared to ignore all of those things? Or do you think that this may further justify his view that now is the moment to engage in what totalitarians, I think, have been calling social engineering, using that threat from the United States or the imperative of unifying with Taiwan to get people's attention off of those problems and onto rallying around the flag and the motherland and the Chinese Communist Party?
Indeed, Frank, I think the latter, and I do so for two reasons. And it was just important to note as well that it was expected that there was a real decline in China's gross domestic product, which they delayed releasing this week. Obviously, they don't want bad economic news to come at the time of the 20th Party Congress. So you're exactly right. The economy is in difficult shape. That's not to say it can't recover and that there are solutions, but the economy is in bad shape. The urgency comes, as you identified, yes, from the fact that if there is sustained economic decline, that challenges the legitimacy of the Chinese Communist Party and thus Xi Jinping's rule. But there are other elements too, Frank, of note. One would be perhaps Xi Jinping is not in the best of health. And so he'll turn 70, of course, next summer. And there are rumors that he has serious health problems. We obviously don't know the scope of those, but that might add an element here as well. Secondly, the Biden administration is reluctant for whatever reason to make the necessary conventional force posture changes as well as necessity of the nuclear changes in the Indo-Pacific as well as elsewhere to deter Chinese aggression. So he has to think that he has a window with the Biden administration. So his personal health, economic decline, perhaps his health issue, and then thirdly, of course, the window of opportunity provided by the Biden administration and the fact that we don't have the right force structure in the Indo-Pacific gives him that window and lends underscores the urgency with which he may act.
This is one of the things that I think was so important about the various programs that I've mentioned, the panel discussion crashing the Party Congress, as we called it, Saturday night, and these webinars that we've been doing, Brad, is this point about elite capture, and specifically the capture of the Biden family itself by the Chinese Communist Party being a consideration in the plans for war of our mortal enemy. It's very, very frightening. But this brings me to the CCP challenge, as we call it. And Brad, I want to thank you for your help in crafting it. It's basically a one-page document that walks you through very quickly the nature of the threats we're facing, as Brad calls it, understanding the China threat. And it also gives you six specific steps that need to be taken now that you can endorse and hopefully pass on to those who are seeking your vote in the next 3 weeks, to impress upon them they need to make this part of their platform. I encourage you to go to presentdangerchina.org or ccpatwar.com to check out what you can do to take action in the face of these threats. Brad Thayer, we have to leave it at that for the moment. The threats are real. Your help in understanding them and in responding to them is absolutely indispensable and deeply appreciated. I know you'll keep up the great work you're doing at the Committee on the Present Danger China, and we look forward to talking.
Thank you, Frank. My pleasure.
In the days ahead. Kimberly Herman of the Southeastern Legal Foundation is up next. We'll talk with her about CRT indoctrination for your kids and more right after this.
bombs and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back. It's always a delight to be able to say we are joined by Kimberly Herman. She is the general counsel of a terrific organization, the Southeastern Legal Foundation, where she is at the pointy end of the spear in terms of trying to protect our civil liberties in the face of what I can only describe as a Marxist revolutionary takedown. Well, both of our constitutional republic and those freedoms that we tend to take all too much for granted. Kimberly, it's always a pleasure to have you with us. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So I want to update with you on something that's getting, I think, more and more attention because it seems as though quite a number of candidates in this fall's election cycle are now really honing in on this as a problem that, you know, the man who is now governor of Virginia, Glenn Youngkin, picked up on a year or so ago. Talk a little bit about this use of something called critical race theory in our public schools and well, for that matter, in government and other employment settings to really indoctrinate targeted individuals in what I think is really a Marxist program, certainly divisive in character and I would argue dangerous as well.
It's extremely dangerous. So critical race theory, as it's being used in our schools, is really the idea that white supremacy is embedded in all of our systems. So our system of government, our schools, and our constitution. So when our schools are going in and teaching our kids things like white people are oppressors, and Black people are oppressed and victims. That is what we mean when we say that schools are teaching critical race theory. It is extremely dangerous.
And when they say that, they're describing that as a permanent and unalterable condition, right? It doesn't matter what you think as a white person or what you think as a Black person. It's just inherent in the color of your skin. That's so at odds with, Martin Luther King's teachings, among others, I think, including the U.S. law, no?
It's completely against U.S. law. And even more, we have schools. So we filed a lawsuit in Springfield Public Schools in Missouri. And as we've been litigating that case, the case is on behalf of teachers who are challenging an anti-racist training that violated their First Amendment rights. And in that case, through discovery, we've actually had the school district say that to believe that our country should be colorblind is itself racist, that our constitution demands that we look at skin color. They went so far as to say that our Civil Rights Act, the law that was enacted to ensure that we do not look at the color of our skin, that we do not treat people differently because of the color of our skin, that it mandates the complete opposite, They are saying they're required to teach this to our kids and to our teachers because of the Constitution and laws. It has turned our Constitution and our laws on our heads. It is dangerous and it needs to stop.
You're a highly accomplished, trained lawyer. How can anybody who professes to be competent in, you know, the judicial system of this country and the legal aspects of our country, let alone our Constitution, make such arguments?
They see the law as something that they're going to use as a weapon on their behalf, and they're going to use our kids as their army to go ahead and undermine the Constitution, right? They know that when you actually look at our laws and our Constitution, that's not what it says. And so the only way that they're going to really take over in the sense of undermining our constitutional republic, as you said when we started talking, is to indoctrinate our kids to see it no other way. And that's why they're doing this in our schools. That's why they're teaching this to kids as young as 4 and 5 years old. Get them then, divide them from the parents, and then they've got them. And so it's really important that we stop this now.
This is another piece of this Marxist revolutionary program, isn't it? That it is about turning children against their parents, getting them, for that matter, even to turn in their parents if they are not with the program. Are you seeing evidence of that in both this indoctrination and its practice?
We are. We're seeing kids that are being required to sign contracts, signing away their whiteness, saying that they get to mess endlessly with the lives and of their friends who are not the same skin color as them. We are having, you know, student surveys. That's another really big area where kids are being asked about their parents' political beliefs. They're being asked about their family home, their parents' mental health, their mental health, really invasive questions without parental consent. All of this is to give the schools and the administrators additional information on the kids to divide them from the parents.
Wow. But I do fear where this inevitably leads is ratting out your parents if they don't subscribe to all of this. But again, I'm just struck by the fact that, as you say, it's turning upside down our constitutions, our civil rights laws, you know, and for that matter, the truth, just fundamentally the truth. White people are not inherently racist. Black people are not inherently oppressed. This is a land of opportunity. It's one of the greatest things about it. And irrespective of the color of your skin or your ethnicity or, you know, your religious beliefs, you are entitled to have those opportunities, not necessarily an outcome, the opportunity to pursue your dreams and happiness and so on. I can't thank you enough, Kimberly, for what you're doing. Just quickly, tell us, these are exercises in indoctrination, to some extent using lawfare as a means of advancing them. You're bringing sort of countervailing pressure to bear very quickly. How is that going, as you see it now?
Yeah, our cases are moving forward very quickly. We have a judge in our Illinois case who has really dove into the issues and is looking at them very, very carefully. And we believe that that's extremely promising. And so we're hopeful that we'll have some rulings in early 2023. And then we can take those positive rulings and we can repeat them throughout the country. So we just encourage parents that as you see this to call us, let us know it's happening. And we're here to help you.
How do they get in touch with you?
Yeah, our website, slfliberty.org.
SLF, Southeastern Legal Foundation. Southeastern Legal Foundation is so important. Let me just ask you, Kimberly, about one other thing that I know you're working hard on as well. Another line of attack in breaking down our society is actually, amazingly, a program that is anti-women, brought to you by the left, which has endlessly professed to be all about women's rights and so on. Talk about what they're doing to Title IX. Remind us what that is, first of all, and what the effects of pursuit of this agenda are.
Yeah, Title IX is in our Civil Rights Act, and it was enacted by Congress to ensure that everyone has an equal opportunity to education, regardless of your sex. And what they're doing is they're redefining what the word sex means to basically include sexual stereotypes, sexual identity, gender identity. It can mean anything. So that's the reason why boys can now go into girls.
Transgenderism.
Yep, exactly. Things, it's the reason why boys are now going into girls' bathrooms. It's the reason why girls have to change in locker rooms in front of boys. It's the reason why kids are getting in trouble if they quote unquote misgender one of their classmates. It's the reason why we have watchdogs and reporting forms now that are going into our schools if anyone believes that somebody offended them. This is really extreme. It's taking Title IX, which was meant to protect everyone, and turning it into a weapon. As you said, they're weaponizing our laws against everyone and against our republic.
Yeah. I mean, the idea of girls changing in front of boys is one thing. Showering with them is another. I mean, it's a formula for what we've already seen some of, which is rape and you know, molestation and other, you know, crimes. There is one other aspect to this, which has gotten, again, some attention. And I think there's now some tracking of all this in the election cycle. Boys competing as girls in ways that are clearly taking advantage of their physical strength and other, you know, characteristics that girls simply don't have is now causing an awful lot of women to lose in competitions they would otherwise be champions in, and the like. Just tie this into the larger seeming disruption of the law and the practice that we hold dear in this country, which is that women do have rights, and they are, among other things, entitled to the right to compete fairly with other women.
I mean, Title IX is really going to destroy the concept of what a woman is. That's what it's doing, right? We see ads where we have, quote unquote,
Title IX as correct, now being
correct. Title, right. Title IX as the Biden administration would like to see it going forward. It is really destroying the concept of what a woman is. We see men, advertisements where men are pregnant. We see men competing in women's sports. They're taking women's scholarships. It's really undermining the idea of what and who a woman is and taking out biology from all of it. We have kids being told that doctors guess what their sex is when they're born, and then they can just pick it to be whatever they want. It's really insane. Correct. To get it right, just because maybe they're a boy who likes to play with a Barbie doll because they have a sister, or a girl who likes to play baseball. It's really destroying who a person can be too, who these kids can be, and taking away being a child.
Yeah, that's all so true. And I would argue it is more at the higher altitude, a real attack on our country and further means of dividing us from each other and undermining who we are, what we believe in, and what we stand for. And I'm so grateful to you, Kimberly, personally, as well as in your corporate role at the Southeastern Legal Foundation, for what you are doing to push back on all of this. I know you will keep it up. I hope you will come back to us with updates on all of it soon. In the meantime, thank you for this important work. Next up, Ambassador Yoram Edinger on the Middle East and more right after this. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. In races across the country, MAGA Republicans Joe Biden considers enemies of the state are surging past Democrats complicit in the president's wrecking operations on our economy, borders, energy security, and the military, to name but a few. Majorities in the House and Senate are now in sufficient jeopardy that Democratic politicians and their media allies have begun discussing a topic they have actively dismissed and suppressed as the big lie of election deniers, namely that fraud can determine electoral outcomes. It seems those who insisted the 2020 presidential election wasn't stolen are now worried races this year may be too lopsided to steal. So, the prospect looms that Team Biden will go for Plan B. If not Putin's nukes or a new pandemic, might the war Xi Jinping has declared on Taiwan be the pretext for postponing our 2022 elections? This is Frank Gaffney. We're back, and I'm always delighted to be able to say we're going to talk with one of the world's leading experts on the Middle East, a man we consult with frequently. There is ferment there, and that seems to be pretty much all the time. But particularly at this moment, there are truly epic prospects, it seems, for change in the direction of the government of Iran. If the people of Iran have their say, at least, and to explore the possibility that they will prevail, and also what other governments in the region, and most especially ours, ought to be doing to try to assure that the people of Iran do, in fact, have a say in who rules them, and, well, more to the point, ends the misruling of them by the present mullahocracy, as I call it. Our guest is Ambassador Yoram Edinger, a very accomplished Israeli diplomat. He served in Washington with the rank of ambassador for a number of years. He is now the editor-in-chief of the Edinger Report, a terrific online newsletter, which I commend to all of you, and very much welcome as a guest here always. Mr. Ambassador, great to have you back. Welcome.
It's my distinct honor to be on your show.
Well, let me ask you first and foremost about the latest developments in Iran. There seems to be now, I guess, going into its fifth week, widespread and I think intensifying demonstrations against the government. Do you see it that way? And if so, are there signs that there is now fracturing taking place within the ruling clique?
In my mind, the events in Iran constitutes a very clear and urgent message to Washington to reassess its policy. There is a direct correlation between domestic policy and external policy. A despotic regime which represses, discriminates against all ethnic and religious minorities, against women in particular, such a regime cannot be approached as a good faith negotiator. Such a regime cannot be referred to as a potential partner or ally of America, because between the values of that regime in Tehran on the one hand and the values for which the U.S. Stands, there is an ocean which cannot be bridged. And the question is, how come the U.S. embraces the Ayatollahs of Iran in defiance of their own abrogation of elementary human rights, and at the same time, they put pressure on Egypt, on Saudi Arabia, supposedly on account of human rights. And last and not least, we have seen the expression of the desire by most Iranians for a regime change, while at the same time, the U.S. administration provides a robust tailwind to the regime in Tehran to remain in place. And that runs contrary to the interests of the peoples of Iran and contrary to the national security interests of the United States.
Couldn't agree more. We'll come back to Egypt and Saudi Arabia, maybe in the second block. But Mr. Ambassador, just staying with Iran, it's one thing if this regime were just abhorrent in terms of the way it treats its own people. The human rights record, the most horrific repression imaginable for now some four decades plus. But they've also made abundantly clear, endlessly, since coming to office in 1979, that they seek not only death to Israel, but death to America. And the purpose of this nuclear weapons program, which I think now everybody acknowledges is what we're dealing with here, not just an atomic program that has nuclear energy purposes that could go that way. This is all about getting the bomb, and has been for decades now. That's clearly at odds with our, as you say, vital interests, our national security interests, as well as those of our friends in the region, most especially Israel. So the Secretary of State met last week with, I believe it was five activists, expat Iranians, and they made the message very clear to do just what you said. Stop these negotiations. Stop the legitimization of this regime. And as best I can tell, the answer they got back was, well, we think we can chew gum and walk at the same time. We're going to be able to have these negotiations ongoing in some form or fashion, maybe slowly, but still ongoing, legitimating the government there, and stand in solidarity with the people of Iran. That didn't seem to satisfy the activists that he was meeting with. Should it satisfy any of us either?
Well, we should not lose sight of the fact that irrespective of Iran's pursuit of nuclear, its conventional capabilities have posed a very, very clear threat, not only to the stability of the Persian Gulf and the Middle East at large, but in fact, to the homeland security in the U.S. As we speak here, the Ayatollahs of Iran are getting deeper and deeper into the terrain of Venezuela. And in Venezuela, not only have they provided Venezuela with Predator unmanned aerial vehicles, and not only have they collaborated with terror organizations, but they have also testing ballistic technologies on Venezuelan ground. They have collaborated with the leading drug cartels of Mexico and Colombia and Bolivia. And in fact, they have done their utmost to undermine the U.S. strategic posture in Latin America,
in the region,
which they rightly consider America's soft belly.
Hold that thought, Mr. Ambassador. We're going to come back with more on Israel, Iran, the Middle East more generally, with Ambassador Yoram Edinger right after this very short commercial message. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back. We are visiting with Ambassador Yoram Edinger, a distinguished Israeli diplomat, now retired, but very actively engaged still in the public policy debate in his native Israel, but also worldwide, among other things, through his terrific online resource, the Edinger Newsletter, the Edinger Report. Mr. Ambassador, you were, I hated to break up that train of thought, but one of the pieces that you've made very clearly plain is Iran is not simply a threat in the region. It's not simply its ballistic missiles. It's not simply its pursuit of nuclear weapons. It is the world's leading state sponsor of terrorism. And you mentioned the tie-in to Venezuela at a moment when we talk a lot about it here in Securing America. The United States has an open border, and large numbers of people are coming from Venezuela. Some of them are now being sent back by the Biden administration, thank God, but lots aren't. And some of them, we have reason to believe, may have Venezuelan passports, but are actually Iranians. And some of them may not have passports at all, but maybe simply getting away, as they say, coming across our border to bring terrorist death and destruction, perhaps, here to our country. So you couldn't be more right that this is a mortal threat to Americans. And it makes all the more maddening the idea that we are going to continue to prop up this regime, especially at a moment when the Iranian people themselves are making clear they want to be rid of them. I want to pivot, though, if I may, in the remaining time we have with you, sir, to some of the other areas of this region you've mentioned are being threatened as well by the Iranians, not just Israel, of course, but Egypt and Saudi Arabia as well. This is happening at a moment when the United States is not only helping prop up a regime that threatens both of them, but is distancing itself from those two longtime friends, allies, I guess is a strong word, but at least relatively friendly nations. And the question is, if the United States government is reassessing its relationship with Saudi Arabia in light of this recent deal to raise OPEC's prices through reducing its production of oil, where is this likely to leave us, do you think, with those nations specifically, but more generally in the region?
Well, the policy by the U.S. since rise to power in the State Department by Tony Blinken, the Secretary of State, the policy has been very, very clear, pressuring Egypt and Saudi Arabia while courting the Ayatollahs of Iran. The pressure on Saudi Arabia and Egypt and the courting of the Iranians is another reflection of the detachment by the State Department from Middle East reality, because the State Department believes that the choice for the U.S. is between Arab regimes which respect human rights, adhere to human rights, and Arab regimes that violate human rights, while in fact in the Middle East the choice is between pro-American regimes that violate human rights and anti-American regimes which violate human rights. And in that respect, the U.S. pressure on the Saudis and the Egyptians on account of human rights while ignoring the dire violations of human rights by the Iranians has pushed both Egypt and Saudi Arabia, as well as the United Arab Emirates, closer towards Russia and China. Those countries, those Arab countries, have concluded that they cannot fully trust the U.S. in their war against Iran, in their attempts to defeat Muslim Brotherhood terrorism, and therefore they have negotiated with Russia and China the acquisition of advanced military systems. And such a trend in the Middle East is promoting Russia and China and severely undermining the U.S., which has had its impact on the exportation of oil from the Persian Gulf, on the quantity of oil produced by Persian Gulf countries, and it will continue in that direction until the U.S. realizes that its focus should be on a regime change in Iran, which is pursued by every single pro-American Arab country in the Middle East, but ignored by the U.S. itself.
Yes. And this is a formula, I fear, for not only further erosion of our position in the Middle East and such relationships as we have there, but the further empowering of the people who are absolutely, you know, animated by hatred of our country. It's hard to conceive of a more misbegotten policy, and I pray that the people of Iran will receive the help they need from us, among others, but needless to say, to effect a change in the nature of that regime for sure. Lastly, and very quickly, Mr. Ambassador, we've only got about a minute left, but there is an election looming in your country, Israel, shortly. Is there any chance that it will actually result in something different than the previous four elections, I guess, which has been stalemate and an unstable government.
In my opinion, there is a small chance that such a transformation will happen. In Israel right now, we have a battle similar to the U.S. between the realists on the one hand and the so-called progressives on the other hand, who indulge themselves in wishful thinking. The realists, basically right of center, who have concluded that any concession to radical regimes whets the appetite of those regimes. And on the other hand, the so-called Israeli progressives, who are convinced that gestures and appeasement and concessions to the radicals in the Middle East is going to moderate them and produce peace. And it remains to be seen what will be the outcome of November 1st election in Israel.
Yeah, this
much
is not...
more, by the way, much more important to us may be the outcome of the November 7th election in the U.S.
Which we'll be watching that closely, Mr. Ambassador. We have to leave it at that. Thank you so much for your time. God bless you and your work. Keep it up and come back to us soon. Thanks to the rest of you for joining us. I hope you do the same.
Thank you.
Stay tuned for more.